Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Must-see TV. That phrase was coined to describe a string of broadcast television smash hits all dished up from the same source, NBC, and watched over by then-NBC President of Entertainment, Warren Littlefield. In a new book he's co-authored about that last golden era in network television, Littlefield says that it all began with Cheers.
Look at what I'm dreaming about! A bartender in an off-the-rack shirt with a button missing.
It's not missing. I always keep it unbuttoned so I can scratch my stomach.
That's Kirstie Alley and Ted Danson in the lead roles of Cheers, an unusual concept at the time, a group of regulars in a Boston tavern. Joining us now to talk about how Cheers evolved and how other greats followed is Warren Littlefield, former NBC president of entertainment. His new book is called Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. Welcome to the show, Warren.
Well, thank you, Ann. It's wonderful to talk to you today.
A question for our listeners. What's your favorite must-see TV show from NBC? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if you need any reminding, Seinfeld, Frasier, Friends, ER, Will and Grace, Mad About You, Third Rock from the Sun, Law and Order, Cheers, The Cosby Show. Warren, when you're in the midst of it, you don't see an era building, I suppose. You're just clawing your way through each day, trying to make something work. But as I read about the development of the shows, even in the era's heyday, you were still scratching and scrapping over development.
Oh, without a doubt. And remember that Cheers, which went on and lasted for 11 years and was a beacon of really who we wanted to be at NBC. Cheers, at the end of its first season, was the lowest rated series in all of network television. And yet, we said, gosh, we believe in this thing. And Brandon Tartikoff and I sat with Grant Tinker, who was our boss at the time, and we said, well, what do we do? And Grant looked at us and said, do you have anything better? And that was it. It was a very simple discussion after that. We didn't, not even close. And we stuck with Cheers. Now, you really have to look to a guy like Bill Cosby, who comes on to Thursday night, and his opening night delivers 34 million Americans into Thursday. He turned the lights on. And once the audience was there for Bill, we were able to say, hey, we've got this other thing. It's called Cheers. It's really pretty good. You ought to stick around. And for the next decade, Cheers is the tentpole right in the middle of Thursday night, really our anchor. And as I say in the book, Ann, it's our DNA.
My guest is Warren Littlefield, former NBC president of entertainment and author of a new book, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. That idea, Warren, of who you wanted to be, that was really important because when you started in that job, nobody really knew. You were very much floundering in general, not just in development.
Well, you know, networks were no longer, at least back then in the 90s, we had the radical thought that networks were no longer quite the kings they used to be. In the average household, they were now getting up to 50 channel choices. And that said to us, we better define our network. We better start really, really looking for an identity the way cable was doing. And so as we said, all right, let's go to our past, and our past, which we really believed in, was a Cheers, a Hill Street Blues, that kind of quality adult entertainment, sophisticated, made for a smart young audience. We said, you know, those are our roots. And Thursday night in the 80s was kind of, we would call, our night of bests. We would take our best new product, and we'd screen it in May in New York at the upfronts. We'd screen an entire pilot in front of the advertisers and the press and say, this is what we believe in. We'd put it on Thursday night. And then as we hit the 90s and we started to really say, all right, let's define this network. Let's really, really take take some shape, we looked for a brand for Thursday. And ultimately, that brand became Must See TV. A brand, as you know, is a promise. It's a bond with your audience. And as we delivered those hits, we just built more and more of a habit with America so that Thursday nights in the 90s, we were finding 75 million Americans would come and watch Thursday night, at least some of Thursday night, because they felt they didn't want to be left out of the discussion the next day at the office.
Cheers came from the desperation to get the brothers Les and Glenn Charles and Jimmy Burrows, to create a show. Any show that was high quality, you said nobody wanted to be on NBC, so you had to overcome that hurdle first.
Oh, yeah. When I started at NBC in comedy development, we had Different Strokes and Hello, Larry. That was it. And over on ABC, they had 14 comedies on the ABC schedule, from Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and Barney Miller and Taxi. CBS had a dozen quality comedies. So we were really starting from the bottom of the heap. But slowly, and it really was Cheers, those quality auspices came in and said, here's what we want to do. And I think our intelligence was we stepped back and said, you're the people we believe in. We spent a lot of money to get in business with you, and we're going to let you do what you believe in.
I was surprised to read James Burroughs say that the guys they pitched the Cheers to knew a lot more about television than the guys they pitched to today. Why is that? What's the difference?
Well, I think one of the things is respect for who's in the room. The writer, and in the case of Jimmy Burrows, probably the greatest comedy director in the history of the medium. We had a lot of respect for who we were sitting at the table with. That's part of it. But then the other side of it is respect for the audience. And the Charles brothers had this really interesting observation, and it was just kind of a throw-out moment, but it stuck with me. They said, you know, the only other comedy on all of network television is Three's Company that deals with young adults. And they said, now, you know, we have nothing against Three's Company, and John Ritter is wonderful, but it seems to us there's a whole lot more territory that we can cover. There's a lot more range of where we can go with relationships and emotion and comedy that nobody has even touched yet. And I thought that was a brilliant observation on their part. And of course, that's exactly where they went. They went and filled that void of relationships and characters that we hadn't heard before, we hadn't seen before on Cheers.
I want to listen to something from The Cosby Show. It was another groundbreaker that relied on Bill Cosby's bit about his family life. So let's listen to a clip of Cliff. He's played by Cosby, of course, and Claire Huxtable, his wife, played by Felicia Rashad. They're getting ready for their son Theo, played by Malcolm Jamal Warner, to leave for college.
All right, I'm ready. There he is, my son, off to college. Boy, I'm proud of you. Oh, my goodness. All right, let's hit it.
Thanks, Dad.
Listen, let me help take out some of these bags.
Oh, wait, this trunk is heavy. Let me help
you. Don't worry about that, honey. No problem. I got lots of energy today.
Strong woman, strong woman. All right.
You know, I get the feeling that you and Mom can't wait to get me out of the house. Aren't you the least bit emotional?
Oh, yes, man. We're going to miss you. Now get your bag.
How did you know, that is a very different concept, a very different approach to production, too, because Bill Cosby had a very strong hand in it.
Oh, without a doubt. We were in Bill's world. And the amazing thing about the actors in that ensemble, Malcolm and Felicia, in that particular scene, they had to follow Bill because Bill used the script oftentimes as an outline. And when Bill was in front of an audience, which is how he made his living for many years, when Bill was in front of a live audience, he could go anywhere, and they had to follow him. And that was just, you were in Bill's world, and that was a wonderful ride. And it really came, and that clip illuminates it, the original premise that Marcy Carsey and Tom Werner, the executive producers, that they came in and said was, here's the show we want to do. There's a war in America's living rooms. It's between parents and children. This is the story of a dad who refuses to lose the war with his teenage children. And it was that kind of attitude, obviously laced with tremendous amount of love, but it was that attitude that said, oh, dad's not a dummy. And we just hadn't seen, there'd been this dumbing down of TV dads for so long. And Bill comes in and just America goes, it's about time.
The creators planned a show originally around a working class family with a stay-at-home mother, but he wanted to change that up too.
Well, Bill, early on, Bill wanted to do a one-hour drama where he was a limo driver. And Tom and Marcy really said, Bill, when you walk out on stage and sit down and do 2 hours, it's about your life. It's about your life, your relationship with your wife and your family. And that's really what we should do. Thank goodness, Bill heard what they said. And the development of that material, the script, and then the casting of the ensemble around him, I never had a development process where we had done it so quickly. It was literally in a number of weeks. A script was written, it was cast, we were on a stage, we did a demo. And when we put that show on the schedule, it changed 4 nights of our schedule because we knew it was that strong. And we finally had something to go up against CBS. CBS had powerful dramas. Magnum P.I., Simon & Simon, they dominated Thursday night. And Bill was the guy who absolutely turned the lights on and just brought a big audience into us. We'd never had that.
The casting process is really interesting to read about through the different shows. I'm not sure it changed so much, but I remember in one story about Friends, you talk about one studio executive or one of the executives had offered a role to somebody that you didn't even know about. And luckily the person turned it down so that you could offer that role to Jennifer Aniston.
Well,
and I'm thinking, oh my gosh.
Yes. the magic and the chemistry of casting, it's so critical. Craig Bierko passed as Chandler. Well, Matthew Perry had done a one-hour pilot for Fox called LAX 2193. Now, it doesn't take a genius to bet against that pilot. So after looking at hundreds of actors for the Chandler role, we knew we really wanted Matthew Perry. We were afraid about having to take him in second position, but ultimately we made that bet against LAX 2193. That all worked out. Jennifer was a lot scarier. We had had her on the air in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She played Ferris's sister when we did a television version without John Hughes. So we all know how that turned out.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer was just someone who I really believed in. We did a few more pilots with her. They weren't particularly good. And I was just hoping that we would finally find the vehicle where we could make it work with Jennifer. I actually bumped into her late one night up on Sunset Boulevard. I was gassing up at a Chevron station, and she was over on the other island doing the same thing. And she came over and she said, is it ever going to happen for me? And I just said, oh, God, I hope so. I really hope so. I hope we'll have something soon. Well, when we had the Friends script, unfortunately, Jennifer had already committed to a CBS show called Muddling Through. And so we had to take Jennifer in second position. And unlike Matthew Perry's bad pilot, Muddling Through actually went forward. So we were in a situation where we had gone into production for the series of Friends. We were sharing Jennifer Aniston with another show, and we legally did not have the right, if Muddling Through got picked up for more episodes, we were going to have to reshoot what we had done with Jennifer, and we were going to have to let her go because we were not in first position. So we gambled millions and millions of dollars making episodes of Friends, saying, God, I hope they cancel Muddling Through. It's really terrible.
I want to talk about Friends some more when we return. My guest is Warren Littlefield, former NBC president of entertainment and author of a new book, co-author of a new book, I should say, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. Listeners out there, is there something in Must-See TV lineup that you remember and care about? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also post your comment on Facebook. And you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Wade Goodwin. Coming up on the next On Point. Echoes from Colorado, Romney on foreign policy, markets on edge. Our weekly news roundtable doubles down on the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. It's 78 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today. There is a chance of a scattered shower or thunderstorm this afternoon, a high near 90 degrees. Scattered showers for tonight, cloudy skies, a low of 70. Mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain on Saturday, a high of 85 degrees. And Sunday, mostly sunny with a high of 88. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Friends entered our lives in 1995, and once again, the concept was new, and once again, another long-lived top 10 rated show. Key to its success was the relationship between off-again, on-again lovers Ross and Rachel, played by David Schwimmer and Jennifer Aniston. Let's listen to them go at it.
This morning you said there was nothing so big that we couldn't work past it together.
No, what the hell did I know?
Look, there's got to be a way we can work past this, okay? I can't imagine my life without you, you know, without these arms and your face and this heart, your good heart, right?
No. I can't. You're a totally different person to me now.
Wow. I mean, that's not the Friends we all often remember, but that story arc, Warren Littlefield, that was from the very beginning to the bitter end.
Absolutely. It spanned the 10 years of the series. For Ross saying to Rachel, hey, maybe we could get together sometime. And that's all he says in the pilot to the two of them inevitably. And it was exactly what the audience wanted, ending up together 10 years later. That's what we all celebrated. And it was a roller coaster ride. I think what the audience loved is, of course, it was wonderfully delivered by the writers and the actors. But it was this emotional, where Seinfeld played on brilliant comedy, Friends played on sensational emotion and heart as well as great laughs. And it was really a soap opera. You know, it took me, half a dozen episodes to really fully appreciate what they were bringing to life and how emotionally connected Friends would be. And the audience got hooked.
I can't remember if it was Friends or not, the discussion about how the storyline continued from show to show, whereas before that, it was a new show every week, a new story every week.
Well, in fairness, mm-hmm. I think you'd have to go back to Cheers to see that, yes, there was always the end of an episode, mm-hmm. but seasons arced out over where they were going with the characters. And I would say that what Friends did is they took that to the next level. And so throughout the year, the obstacles for Ross and Rachel to get together, the other relationships that they jumped into, all of those were wonderfully plotted out. And so if you missed a couple of episodes, you wouldn't feel like it was a daytime soap opera, that you were completely left out of the loop. But it was brilliantly plotted so that the season had an arc, and you were left at the end of the season going, oh, my God, will they ever get back together? And that's what we rooted for. Really quite amazing.
What is it that we love about the I've lost the word, but the group, the having a group of characters in a story versus one big star like Magnum P.I.?
Well, you know, I think one of the things we tried to illuminate, and I imagined that at that time, being 20-something and leaving the nest of home and family, that's a really huge transition. Of course, today we know it's just as big because there's an awful lot of kids that move back in with mom and dad. They can't get out there on their own. But it seemed to me that the first loves, first jobs, first loss, first all those experiences that are really difficult to navigate as a 20-something, post-college, that those, for some reason, hadn't been illuminated in a half-hour show. They really weren't a part of television. So for us, it was kind of a development goal. And I developed a number of scripts that went to that idea, and they were dreadful. They really didn't feel honest, didn't feel true. And then it was Marta Kaufman and David Crane who came in and said, this is our story. This is our life. We could have filmed it because as writers, it came out of their souls, and it was wildly, wildly funny and entertaining. And they knew in that initial pitch where the series was going to go. Looking at it when I wrote the book, I went back and read their pitch document. And 10 years later, all the elements that were in the series over that decade were all in those initial 10 pages. So they really had a sense. They were connected, so connected to what that journey would be that it felt real. It felt honest. And all the pretenders that came after Friends, I think the audience is pretty smart, and the audience could smell that they were just pretenders versus Friends, the original, not only wildly entertaining, but felt like it was real.
My guest is Warren Littlefield. He's former NBC president of entertainment and author of a new book, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. One of the things that struck me, I think it was during the Friends, the discussion in the book about Friends, was the issue of fame. And when I looked back over the panorama of shows that you were you ushered through that decade, I thought of all the people that I'd never heard of before that are now household names. I mean, everyone from Helen Hunt to Kelsey Grammer to David Hyde Pierce, David Schwimmer. I mean, it goes on and on. Noah Wiley. I mean, it just goes on and on. Even someone like James Burroughs.
Yeah.
Usually people don't know people like James Burroughs, but he's relatively familiar. And there was this great story about the Friends cast traveling to Las Vegas for their last night of anonymity.
Well, this was after the pilot was made, mm-hmm. and to be on that stage and feel the audience respond to this young cast, and you're absolutely right, Anne. Our strategy was television makes stars. We don't have to go out and find household names in the right vehicles, the right shows. We'll make them household names. And that, of course, is what we did. Jimmy could see it. He could feel it after the pilot. And Jimmy knows, after all, he was a co-creator and executive producer of Cheers. And with Friends, he was excited. He said to Les Moonves, who now is CEO of CBS, and Les was at Warner Brothers at the time, he said, get me a plane. I'm taking this cast to Vegas, and we're going to have a night. and Jimmy took them. None of them had money. He lent all of them money so that they could gamble a little bit. And they had dinner at the Palm, and they sat at a table, and he looked at them and said, "Look around." He said, "This is the last time you'll be able to do this, that we'll just sit here, we'll have food, no one will come up to us, no one will bother us, and it'll never be like this again. Your lives are going to change dramatically." And they're like, "Oh, whatever, Jimmy." And but he knew it. And the research was on that pilot. Okay, it was a high week. It didn't matter to us. We loved it. We believed in it, and that's why we put it on Thursday night.
Let's turn our thoughts to another huge show, Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
Remember must-see TV, that string of hits. It's an amazing story. It lasted 9 seasons, ending in 1998 in a jail cell where Jerry Seinfeld dishes up his last stand-up of the series. Let's listen.
So, anyone from Cell Block D?
I am.
I'll talk slower. I'm kidding. I love Cell Block D. My friend George is in Cell Block D. What are you in for, sir?
Murder One.
Murder One? Ooh, watch out, everybody. Better be nice to you. I'm only kidding, sir. Lighten up. How about you? What are you in for?
Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto. Don't steal any of my jokes.
You suck. I'm going to cut you.
Hey, I don't come down to where you work and knock the license plate out of your hand.
All right, fine. So let's go. Come on.
All right. Hey, you've been great. See you in the cafeteria.
I think it's kind of interesting. I'd actually forgot about that segment of the last show. But you said that the magic of Cheers and Seinfeld was that they were both shows that Madison Avenue watched.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Well, again, Seinfeld famously, the pilot episode that did not have Julia Louis-Dreyfus in it, the pilot episode, the test results were absolutely disastrous. They knew in the test audience who Jerry Seinfeld was. And they enjoyed his stand-up. They just didn't like the show. They didn't think any of the support people around Jerry were very good. And I have a autographed by the entire cast and Larry David. I have a copy of the original test report from the pilot. Overall evaluation, weak. It's on the wall right next to my desk. And and I look at that every day. And it's a reminder that you don't always listen to test audiences. And if you want to do something different, then don't expect test audiences to tell you that you're heading in the right direction. So it was something that screened well when we screened it with management after pilot season, before we set the schedule. But the results were so terrible, it scared us. So we went forward with things like Sister Kate and The Nut House, shows that never amounted to anything. And then finally, before we were going to lose the rights to continue Seinfeld, I was able to steal some money from a specials budget. We took it away from Bob Hope, actually, and we made 4 episodes of Seinfeld, and we put them on in the summer after Cheers, and they did okay. They didn't do great. It wasn't a disaster. And particularly young men were going, "Hey, these guys are kind of crazy and sometimes stupid, and I get them." And then ultimately we said, you know what, Jerry and Larry, they have voices in their head that aren't on television. They're playing by their own rules. What they do scares us a little bit, and it's not as though they've ever done this before, but it's funny. It is memorably, memorably funny, and we want to be on their plane. We want to take a ride with them, and so I went forward and then ordered another 13 episodes, and we put that up against Home Improvement Wednesday nights, and we got killed. Home Improvement was through the roof. We were getting a fraction of their audience. And yet, we still felt that there was something wonderful about that show. Ultimately, when Cheers said goodbye, we moved Seinfeld to Thursday night. Of course, Larry David said, hey, if they haven't been with us before, I don't want any of those Thursday people. and Jerry, of course, told Larry that we would be fine on Thursday. And amazingly, as Cheers did their final lap and we moved Seinfeld in, Seinfeld actually eclipsed the Cheers performance. And that became, for the next decade, the anchor to Thursday night.
Jerry Seinfeld said something in the book that makes me realize, number one, how really cool he thought it was, even at the end, toward the end, that he still had that feeling of wow. But he said, I got one of the last big rides on the television rocket where you could literally control the dialogue of the country. I mean, talk about memorable.
Yes. Yeah. And Jerry was unbelievably dedicated to the process. If I wanted to get a hold of him, nights, days, weekends, I always knew where to find him. He was over at the production office. He was either writing or he was in post-production. He was completely dedicated to the show. And then with a comic's timing, Jerry said, I think it's time for me to get off the stage. They were the number one comedy in America. And despite the fact that we went to Jerry with a massive, massive amount of money and said, we need you to come back for one more year. And we'd done that. I'd done it a number of times with Jerry previously, and it had all worked out. But he said to me, you know, I don't have a life. I'm not married. I don't have children. I've only got the show, and now I have tremendous success. I think I have to go find a life. And I realized that you can't negotiate against that.
In the book, Seinfeld is noted as the beginning of the end of must-see TV. How so? What impact did Seinfeld have on the fall from the top?
Well, Seinfeld was a huge anchor to must-see TV. It was a absolute destination. And you know, the book is a celebration of one network, one night for one decade. And we were able to navigate from Cheers going away to Seinfeld taking over that role. Of course, Will and Grace came on to Thursday night, and that became another destination. But once Seinfeld was gone, it really started to be the beginning of the end of the must-see era. ER lasted, and that was a beacon at the end of the evening after those comedies. Mm-hmm. ER was there for 15 years. You know, must-see continued beyond Seinfeld, but never with quite the same strength.
My guest is Warren Littlefield, former NBC president of entertainment and author of a new book, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hey, did you hear your car talk last week?
He threatened that if I didn't stop doing that, he would let his mother move in with us. I really like her a lot, but...
No, you don't.
No, nay.
You have no idea.
Do anything. In fact, throw all the keys away.
Including the ones to the house. Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend begins with Classical 101 host Christopher Purdy and a discussion of the arts in Central Ohio with Ballet Met, the Columbus Museum of Art, and CATCO. That's All Sides Weekend from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 79 degrees in downtown Columbus. Scattered showers and thunderstorms mainly this afternoon. Otherwise, partly sunny skies, a high of 90. Scattered showers for tonight, cloudy skies, a low of 70 degrees. A few clouds with a slight chance of rain on Saturday, and a high of 85. When you support 89.7 NPR News at the annual level of $85, our gift to you is the WOSU Public Media Member Card. The Member Card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 300 Member Card partners in and around Central Ohio. Save money and support our station with the Member Card. Make a gift of $85 or more. Visit us now at WOSU.org/membercard for more information. And thanks for your support.
My guest is Warren Littlefield, former NBC president of entertainment and author of a new book, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. Warren, I want to talk a little bit about the book itself and how you put it together as kind of like a script.
Well, initially I didn't set out to do it that way. When I left NBC, when they told me my time was up, I just took everything, my files, photos, mementos, everything, threw it into boxes and into a storage unit and walked away. I focused in the present. I kind of didn't look to the past. And after 10 years of paying rent each month to a public storage unit, I went back on a Saturday afternoon and I kind of rambled around in that unit and opened boxes and looked at everything and said, you know, maybe it's time to look at the past. This is a pretty remarkable group of programs and the people who created them and the relationship that the audience had to this product will never be matched. That kind of destination can't be found in television. And given the age of choice that we now live in, it'll never happen again. So I set out to research, and I met with over 54 writers, producers, actors, executives, heads of corporations, everyone who I thought had an important voice in the story. So I did multiple-hour interviews with them, 1,500 pages of transcripts from my interviews, and then really put that into the narrative form that it is. I worked with Jerry Seinfeld for over a decade, and so his words are laced throughout a lot of the story, beginning, middle, and end. And so many of the people that all their lives changed dramatically when they were a part of Must-See TV. Noah Wiley was 25 when he started ER, and he was 40 when he left. That's a remarkable change in someone's life, and he just has a great perspective on all of it.
Did you ask anybody to be interviewed for the book who would not be interviewed?
I never got any hard turndowns, but some schedules just didn't work out. I mean, you do have a lot of these people became household names from these shows, and they're all over the world doing feature films, and their lives are pretty busy. So there are a couple of people who I was hoping to get and ultimately just kind of ran out of time. But the overwhelming majority said, I'd love to go back. I'd love to look at those shows, look at that era. And that was my desire, to take the audience who loved this product and give them a seat at the table. Juliana Margulies we gave her an offer to continue as a series regular in Homicide: Life on the Street. We'd killed her off in the ER pilot. And then, thank goodness, decided maybe she should live. And I had no idea what was the basis. When I said, look, we need to make the actor decide. Homicide is a wonderful show. We actually owned it at NBC Studios. And I wasn't going to make that decision. I said, we'll let the actress decide which series she'd like to continue with. And I didn't know until I interviewed Juliana, and I said, well, how did you make that decision? And she goes, well, George called me. George called me and said, I just left Warren. You're going to live, and you have to come do the show. She goes, well, you know, no one says no to George. And
George Clooney.
Yes, George Clooney. And so that's, of course, how that happened. I didn't realize that.
He was an interesting bit in the book about him pulling that cast together and saying, we're going to do this. We're going to make it work. We're going to be friends. We're going to be nice. No rat killing, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, George had famously been on a number of disastrous television shows. He actually had been in a sitcom called Emergency Room, and he hated the process. And he had seen a lot of spoiled people not do great work. And George Clooney's a pretty smart guy. And his antenna, his instincts said, this is going to work. In fact, when the script was first starting to get circulated, George was on and off the Warner Brothers lot all the time, and he got a hold of the script and prepared for the role of Dr. Ross, and he plunked himself in front of John Wells' office, sat down, and he would not leave until John Wells would let him read for the role. And John called me up and said, hey, I just read George Clooney. And I said, yeah. And he goes, yeah, he's really pretty good. I think he's a serious contender. And we had watched George kind of grow as an actor, and he had just done an arc with Celia Ward on Sisters. And we said, yeah, we believe you. But George campaigned for it. He knew there was something special. He got the role. And then when he looked at all of that huge ensemble and he said, we're not going to blow this. We're not going to turn into prima donnas. We will come to work on time and prepared. We're going to make this happen. And he was a wonderful ringleader and really set the tone. And when we lost George to the big screen, everything that he stood for stayed with that show for the next decade beyond George's run.
I wanted to talk about Frasier, and I have to tell you that this morning when I was going through the clips, the audio clips, I got stuck on one of the shows, and I ended up watching the whole thing.
Well, good, man, that's wonderful.
Because it was a lot of fun, and this is a scene from that. That show. Kelsey Grammer, in this clip, Frasier and Niles are at their favorite coffee shop when Niles spots Frasier's agent, B.B. Glazer, played by Harriet Sansom Harris.
Oh, dear, don't turn around. It's that dreadful woman who works for you. Who? Lady Macbeth without the sincerity. Oh, B.B.'s here. Oh, yes. Now, listen, Niles. Care for her just as little as you do, but she is a terrific agent, which is why I overlook the fact that she's pushy and obnoxious and the most appalling phony I've ever known. Beepy, darling, how are you?
You know, that scene is, you know, it brings out all the wit that the program was so famous for. It's hilarious, but it also talks about or says something about the affection between the brothers, which was really interesting to watch and enjoy.
Well, amazingly, Frasier, when it's all said and done, was a family comedy, and a territory that was hugely relatable that no one was dealing with in television. And that is, what do you do when you have an aging parent who needs your help and support emotionally, financially? And in this case, we have a psychiatrist who is very set in his ways, wants his own life his way, and his brother is even more extreme. And over a cup of coffee, they go, who's going to take Dad? And really, really, you know, no little kids running around, not that kind of a family comedy, but an adult family comedy that talks about responsibility and this kind of, I'm not going to take him, you take him. And those characters were brilliant. Originally, Kelsey Grammer, who had played the Frasier character by the way, wasn't the first choice. John Lithgow was the first choice to play that character. Kelsey, unknown, yet again, another unknown face, but a brilliant surgeon-like actor of how he could deliver the material and just nail it. And what was supposed to be four episodes in Cheers ended up being from the 11-year run of Frasier and a 20-year run of playing that character. But that's not what he wanted to do. He really wanted to get away from the Frasier character originally, and the writers were very, very nervous about doing a show that would be after Cheers, you know, would be a bad spinoff. And it was their desire to say, you know what, we're going to really separate from the bar of Cheers. We're going to go all the way across the country to Seattle. We're going to do the radio call-in show. We're really going to find our own identity. And they were absolutely right. And that gave us something that felt wholly original and yet with a character that the audience already knew and loved. And Frasier ended up eclipsing in awards the brilliant performance of Cheers. So it worked out quite well.
The David Hyde Pierce character, was that originally in the show or was it brought in because of David Hyde Pierce?
Well, David Hyde Pierce had been in a short-lived comedy series called The Powers That Be that we were doing with Norman Lear. The original pilot script was actually written by the creators of Friends, Marta Kaufman and David Crane. And he was just sensational in it. The show didn't really work, but David Hyde Pierce was wonderful. And Laurie Opendon, in casting, said, take a look at this. She literally sent over an 8x10 black and white photo and said, doesn't this guy look like he should be Kelsey Grammer's brother? And when they started to look at the tape and the episodes, the producers went, yeah, maybe there should be a brother. And, of course, that was a brilliant ingredient to what made that show work.
Will and Grace earned 16 Emmy Awards along with 83 Emmy nominations over its 8 seasons. Let's listen to a clip where Jack, one of Will's best friends and a principal character in the show as well, is obsessively drinking coffee to visit his new crush.
Hey, friends, lovers, mothers, and other strangers, you're never going to believe what happened to me. Oh, my gosh, did you see that? I almost did a half Nelson. I almost bruised my delicates, my domo origatus, Mr. Tomatoes. Huge news! I have met, are you ready for this, Mr. Wright? Well, Mr. Wright now anyway, but good night, folks. I'm here all week. Jack 2000! He works over at the Jum and Java, you know, that coffee shop in 72nd, and his name is Paul, and he is cute with a capital Q. And the busier it gets, the hotter he gets, and the hotter he gets, the sweater he gets, and the sweater he gets. I forgot where I'm going with this, but the point is, me like he and he like me, and the best part is Shazam! He can see free iced coffee every time I go in, which is every hour on the hour, thank you very much, and occasionally on the half hour.
Sean Hayes.
You have to love him. No one like him, and he just has the music in his head of what Jack was, and wow, could he deliver.
You talk about breaking a glass ceiling. No one thought it could work. Why did you take a chance then on a show like that, Will and Grace?
Well, I had actually, for a long time, as I try and look at the world around me, and I said, I know this relationship, a gay guy, straight girl, they're best friends. So if we're the network of young urban adults, if we're the network that's supposed to have all these relationships and examine whether it's the Niles and Frasier and how they deal with dad, or let's look at the relationships of friends, or let's look at a gay man and a straight woman and their unique bond. It just seemed to me that that was a gap that we were missing. And so I absolutely believed in the idea. And when Max Muchnick and David Cohen came in and pitched a big ensemble show where kind of over in the lower right-hand corner were the Will and Grace relationship. I said, that's your center. That's the center of the show that I would like you to do. And they said, well, I mean, if we can do that, but you'll never put that on the air, will you? And my response was, well, if you do a really good job, then I have to. And then my management said, you're out of your mind. Advertisers will not put this gay relationship, you know, they will not put this on the air. They won't support it. We'll lose money. That's not the business we're in. And I just said, you know what? It's a script, and this is my job. And as long as I have my job, this is what I want to do. And, of course, the script was wonderful. And then I went to the comedy genius of the planet, Jimmy Burrows, and I said, Jimmy, I love this. I believe in it. Please read it. And Jimmy said, it's great. Let me sit with the boys. And then I said to my management, guess what? I'm making it, and Jimmy Burrows is directing. Hey, it's just a pilot. It probably won't work. Most pilots don't.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of head scratching, a lot of doubting. But when we put that cast together, Eric McCormick brilliantly matched up with Deborah Messing, Nicolette Sheridan also read for the role of Grace, she wasn't the one. And then Megan Mullally and Sean really, really brilliantly filled out the cast. And when we screened that pilot, the CEO of NBC, Bob Wright, said, we've never had anything with our name on it that's as good as this. And that was it. The controversy was over. Now it was just a question of whether the advertisers would support it. And the advertisers had no problem whatsoever. They just said, we get it. It's a wonderful comedy.
Times had changed, and it was reflected in must-see TV. Warren Littlefield, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Ann. Thank you so much.
Warren Littlefield, he's former NBC president of entertainment and author of a new book, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.